and welcome to our podcast. My name is Robert Payne. I'm a principal consultant with Prospectus, and I've been with the organization now for over 18 years. Prospectus has been a leading charity sector recruiter now for over 60 years and recruits at all levels, from CEOs to head of departments, from directors, managers, officers and coordinators to specialist disciplines such as HR, communications, finance and policy. For the past 10 years or so, I have specialized purely in recruiting to trust foundations and grant-making organizations. We thought it would be a good idea to get together to discuss some of our approaches and learnings over the past few years when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. One of the catalysts for this session was a conversation we had with one of our clients when taking a briefing on a key role for their organization, where they asked very pointedly, how can we work together to make sure that we achieve the most diverse shortlist possible for this role? For years now, we've been striving to make sure that our processes and practices are as equitable and outreaching as possible to people from diverse communities. We've been asked this question many times in various ways by our clients. What we've decided to do here is to answer these questions and to set out some of the practices we've developed internally and some approaches and insight we have learned from our candidates and clients externally, and to share them with you in this podcast. As DEI is such an encompassing and nuanced subject, in order to delve a little deeper into the specific dynamics of various protected characteristics, we've decided to produce a short series of podcasts looking individually at some of the following areas, which are people from Black and minoritized communities, those who experience both physical, mental, and neurodiverse disabilities, and finally, gender and LGBTQ community issues. This is in order to explore more deeply specific characteristics of each segment, to try to come up with some tailored and useful tips for each. We are more than conscious that there will be connected intersectional components, of course, throughout the series, but we feel this is a useful way to explore the subjects more deeply throughout. In fact, the connected dynamics being repeated will hopefully serve to emphasize their importance. For the first session on supporting greater representation for people from Black and minoritized communities, we have put together a panel of colleagues here at Prospectus to share their experiences, thoughts, and learnings on this area. So without further ado, I will let them introduce themselves.
Hi, everybody. My name is Zola Diabanza. I am a recruitment consultant here with Prospectus. I have been here just under 2 years within the senior recruitment team and also the charity core team. I am passionate about EDI belonging and creating a positive work environment. And I also lead the anti-racism committee here at Prospectus.
Hi, everyone. My name is Awais. I've been at Prospectus just under 2 years now. I'm a part of our charity core team. I currently specialize in sourcing for communications and marketing roles. I have a background in employability and was first exposed to the charity sector in 2020 when I was a beneficiary of a program.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Nick Bellamy. I'm a client partner on the recruitment advertising team here at Prospectus. What it means for me is working in the advertising team is I advise clients on the best practice when it comes to all things recruitment advertising. So from advert copy to job board placement, looking at data and insights to make informed decisions on the best routes to market for clients to get the best return on investment and reach the widest, most diverse candidate pools.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Till. I lead the senior recruitment team here at Prospectus, which looks after all kind of head of and director level positions within the charity sector. I've got a background in trust and foundations, working within this discipline for the last 5 years, having been at Prospectus for 7 years. And you know, naturally, a lot of these questions I get asked are of the utmost importance at these senior levels.
Great. Thank you all. So to get the conversation going, we have selected some questions which we have been asked by our clients when recruiting and supporting them with new roles. So the first question that we have is, what does diversity and representation mean to us in the recruitment and shortlisting context? Just to start off on that, I think really the charity sector as a whole, I think, is very underrepresented. I think it's well known to those in the sector. You know, for instance, I know that there are far less CEOs in charities than there from a Black and minoritized communities than there were a couple of years ago. So whatever we're doing, we're not necessarily getting it right at this point. So obviously representation is very important in that context.
From an advertising perspective, we get asked it a lot about, you know, how can we reach wider, diverse candidate pools through recruitment. And I think in my role, representation in recruitment advertising and ensuring that job opportunities can reach the broadest audiences possible and attract candidates from all types of backgrounds. Diversity to me means being an inclusive employer and workplace and supporting our clients as our roles as recruiters to recruit a workforce that represents the diverse communities that we serve and being committed to increasing diversity within the sector. And I truly believe that however you identify or whatever background you bring with you, you should have the confidence to be a true self at work. And I think it's really important that when we're having these discussions and thinking about that, that is the case and brands believe in.
Yeah.
Well, just to follow on from Nick's point, I really echo it's about that belonging piece and being able to bring yourself to work fully regardless of your background. And actually just embrace that these differences is what makes us unique and brings so much to an organization when you have different perspectives. So it really is about representing us as a society, as well as an organization. We want to see and hear different voices and opinions.
Brilliant. Yeah. And I think further on from that, really, I think there's a massive talent pool out there in diverse communities that the charity sector will be missing out on if we don't reach out to as many different people as possible, because I think it's well documented that diverse organizations across the board tend to be more successful in general and more creative and more progressive, you know. So that's something that's very important to us here at Perspectus. I think that's something that we've concentrated on internally, and hopefully that is what we can, you know, we can assist in affecting change with our clients as well.
Yeah, I think for me, it's about getting people from as many different types of backgrounds as possible to that shortlisting stage and presenting a wide demographic of different types of people. I think particularly in leadership roles, when there is that systemic challenge where there are not that many leaders from Black and minoritized communities there, I think that there's a nervousness at the moment, I think, sometimes in the charity sector where, you know, people want people to hit the ground running and they want them to come in and be able to do the role as is. When you have a systemic challenge like that, you know, that nervousness doesn't help. You know, you want to be able to be open and to bring people into roles and let them learn, let them develop. And I think more importantly, if someone can do a full role when they enter that position, they're not going to stick around for very long. You know, I think it needs to create space and breadth for people to grow and learn and develop in that. And I do think that, you know, by removing that nervousness, that will inherently allow for greater diversity to come into your organization.
And eventually affect change across the wider cross-section of community as well, which is obviously one of the main aims of the endeavor. Weiss, do you have any points to make on that in terms of what does increasing representation mean to you?
Yeah, for me, it means that we have people from all sorts of other various different positions in the sector representing us as well, not just frontline roles, but was at a more senior level. And when we're looking at boards, the people, you know, making the important decisions for these organizations that we are represented and our voices are being heard.
Yeah. So rest assured that it is a massive priority for us. And really that reflects our client base. As we mentioned at the introduction, our clients have been talking to us for years about making sure that we get as a diverse selection of candidates for them. So that, you know, from our perspective, this is a major priority moving forward. So moving on to the second question, what do people from Black and minoritized communities look for in a role? And how do they view career progression and personal development potential within the charity sector? Zola?
I think what I look for example, as a Black African woman is representation. I do look at an organization to see how diverse they are. Everybody wants to walk into an environment where they'll be able to see themselves and be represented and have their voices heard. I also look for an anti-racism stance, a public declaration that this isn't something that you stand for as an organization. And I also look for a personalized stance, personalized message to show people that we are passionate about understanding EDI, understanding how to support our staff, and not just getting our staff through the door, but also make sure that there is a belonging piece and there is inclusion within the work environment.
From my perspective, I think, you know, being South Asian, what I look for is an inclusive culture to ensure that, you know, obviously being a Muslim, that there is certain policies in place to ensure that, you know, when it comes to prayer or when it comes to maybe it could be halal food, that there is things in place for me to comfortably just be myself at work, really, and carry that out without feeling like I'm a burden. But again, just, you know, looking at personal development opportunities that I had, I've recently joined a forum for networking with South Asians, and I did put this question towards four of them, and it's about 130 of them in this chat. And you know, there is some cultural issues, I think, why maybe people from, you know, the South Asian community aren't considering the non-for-profit sector. And I think there is a lot of people are skeptical because they may have had a bad experience with charity or overseas, which is kind of stop them from looking for a role in the sector. And I think another thing is that personal development piece in our culture, obviously, when it comes to jobs, and I'm talking from my perspective, the charity sector is not spoken about at all. So there's not that awareness on how rewarding the charity sector could be. So I think it's just, you know, bringing more awareness surrounding those issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think awareness is a big thing that will be coming up in this conversation, really, isn't it? About the charity sector, making sure that they, firstly, on an individual basis as charities and grant makers themselves, making sure that their brand is strong and describing their the multicultural nature of their organization. And through that, then attracting the right level of interest from those communities. And Matt, what are your thoughts on this subject? Obviously, you're not from a Black minoritized community, but we've heard from our colleagues. But obviously, we as consultants speak to candidates from those communities, and you know, we've heard what they say, etc. I mean, what would your observations be on this particular question?
Yeah, I think from some of the conversations that I've had, I think comments have been about somewhat with capped ambition. You know, I think you can only move as fast as the person in front of you. And I think that, you know, that might not necessarily be the case in commercial organizations, you know, whereas in the charity sector, there's only a limit of the role in front of you, I think. And I think that can be sometimes be a challenge, is you can be ready to make that development and you can be ready to make that step up into that next position. But the person in that role is there. You cannot make that move unless you move out. And I think that can sometimes be a challenge, and it can mean that people aren't developing as quickly as they would like to, some of the comments I've heard. And just as a final point, kind of echoing what Zola said there, you know, I have had candidates drop out of processes because they've looked at the website and they've looked at the board and they've looked at the leadership team and they've said, there's no one like me here. And it, you know, it creates that perception of what it might be like to work there, and they don't feel like that there will be that sense of belonging. So, you know, I think that how the organization looks at that very senior level can have a huge impact on their attractiveness to Black and minoritized communities with an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And Nick, from your perspective, from an advertising perspective, do clients ask you this type of question, or do they ask you for any insight into feedback you have from people from Black and minoritized communities on in responses to adverts, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do a bit of work around employee value proposition. I think what Zola touched on there was really pertinent about the imagery and representation piece in organizations. And I think especially in the grants and foundations area, a lot of the time we tend to notice grants and foundations, they'll talk about the grants that they've given and the organizations that they've given their grants to. But maybe show the representation in those organizations, potentially put an imagery around that, but less so talking about themselves as an organization and their internal teams as well. And I think looking at that and thinking about the representation and being open and honest about that, and then being able to see other people that are potentially working in your organization and being representative of those Black and minority communities is really important. So I think it's an open and honest conversation as well, right? I think, you know, everyone and every organization is on a journey when it comes to diversity and inclusion. And, you know, not everyone's, and there isn't a perfect way of going about it, but being open and honest and showing that you're trying and you're actually working at this, and it's a focus, and it's not just something that you know that you've got a page and a website about, but it runs through everything that you do. It's really, really important. And I think being really authentic about it is really important, and open and honest, and saying, right, you know, we're not perfect, yeah, and but this is where we're at, and this is what we want to do. You know, we really want to represent the communities that we serve in, and this is how we're going about it.
Yeah. And having those honest conversations, as you say, that, you know, historically, I think people have been nervous of having, and we can, I think we as an organization understand the nervousness around these conversations. But, you know, the more that we've spoken over the past couple of months in preparing this podcast, the more you talk, the easier it becomes. Underrepresentation is a big issue in the charity sector, and things aren't really going to be moving forward until those open and honest conversations are had. And then we, as a sector, you can look to reach out to those communities a little bit more effectively and more authentically, I guess, isn't it? So, you know, because all the right intentions are there, I think. It's just about having the tools and the knowledge to know where to go, know where to look, and know who to speak to, I guess, really. Brilliant. Thank you for that. The third question we have is, what have we found works when it comes to maximizing the exposure of our roles to Black and minoritized communities? How do we ensure the best representation possible in our shortlists? I'll just start off on that briefly, because I do wonder sometimes whether part of the journey is it a numbers game? I think what one of the things that has worked historically is, you know, something that we will touch on, is removing barriers to entry. And I think one example springs to mind is that with one of our grant makers that we were talking to recently, when devising a specific grants manager role, it was decided mutually that grant making experience itself wasn't essential for the role, just an understanding and a knowledge of the charity sector would suffice. This, I think, is a good example of removing a barrier, because out of that advertisement, I think we had upwards of over 200 applications. We had many more candidates to choose from. And as a result of that, we were able to create a shortlist that ultimately worked out to around a 70-30 split in favor of people from diverse communities. We were really, really happy with that response. And as a result of taking away that barrier, we were able then to reach out to far more people than we were otherwise. And the result of that was a great, strong, diverse shortlist. And I think that is something that has motivated us on to sort of look at other barriers that we can look at removing in other areas of job descriptions, for example. Nick, I think you had a point to mention on job search and advertising, you know, what has worked for you and your clients in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Robbie. So I think, you know, we get asked this question a lot, is how, from an advertising perspective, can we reach a wider and more diverse candidate base? And there's lots of job sites out there that cater to specific communities that can certainly have an impact on application numbers. But as standalone products and as standalone as simply just posting your one individual job on these one-off job sites, it's not going to deliver significant increase in the application numbers from candidates with specific characteristics. So it's really important, and when we were talking earlier about authenticity and working with organisations to understand the employer value and the opportunities to those from different backgrounds and how they'll be able to reach out effectively, I guess. When it comes to advertising, there's two ways to advertise, really. So it's reaching active job seekers on the job board and also passive job seekers. And I think, as Zola mentioned again, that passive job seeking and Oasis as well, talking about, you know, candidates may not necessarily think about looking to move into the charity sector, but by reaching those passive job seekers through social media, etc., and using really emotive imagery, we can find a really positive way and a really good way of getting roles in front of candidates that may not necessarily originally have thought of applying for a role at a grants or foundations organization or even in the charity sector in general.
Yeah. And obviously we've talked about the strength of branding when it comes to advertising, etc., and showing yourselves to be an organization that is diverse. I wondered what the panel thought about, you know, imagery when you're applying for a job. Is the imagery that you see important to you in making a decision as to whether to apply for a role, etc.? Or how important do we think imagery is in this process? Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think imagery is really powerful. And I think giving a real sense of what it is like to work at the organization is really important. I think recently CharityJob did a survey of what is really important to candidates when looking for their next role. And the things that people put as very important, you know, tiered as workplace culture, the impact the charity was having, and then it was the salary, you know. So it's very, very important for candidates about what the organization is doing. And it's very important to candidates about what it's like to work there. So I do think that the imagery that you show of the organization, the work that it does, what it's like to work there, what's the culture like, I think that's incredibly important as younger and younger generations are putting more and more emphasis on the social good and the impact of the work of the organization they work for. That automatically makes your organization really attractive to people when they can see the impact that they're going to be having and the culture that they'd be joining.
Yeah, so imagery and advertising is really important. Awais?
Yeah, just on that point, just to, you know, Matt kind of already touched upon it, but, you know, when you do see imagery, which is, it could have someone, for example, with a hijab on and or someone with a visible disability, it shows that organizations really try to ensure that it's included everyone in something as so simple as an image. And I think the younger generation are getting really inquisitive. So a simple image like that, you know, speak 1,000 words, and it shows that they're inclusive and they care, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And Zola, in terms of, I think, in order to be inclusive or in order to get diverse shortlists, one needs to sort of present and be authentically an inclusive organization. I think you support, you wrote an article recently on the HALO program, didn't you? I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, of course. So the HALO code is a code that came about, really started in schools. It was addressing students of Black and Asian backgrounds and their hairstyles and comfortability in order to go into school with your natural hairstyle. For example, majority of the time, due to the weather in the UK, my hair is actually in a protective hairstyle because the cold weather is not great for my hair. So that includes braids, it could include locks, it could include twists. And schools were actually sending children home and deeming these hairstyles inappropriate when they weren't. They were just Black protective hairstyles for your school. So this code came about primarily for schools. However, that goes into the workplace as well. Myself in the past, I've been very conscious of the hairstyles that I will have when I go for an interview or when I start a job, or even being nervous to change my hairstyle to avoid questions about my hair and why I'm able to change hairstyles 6-7 times in a year. It was really impactful that once speaking to my head of HR regarding the HALO program, it was actually implemented and we signed on straight away. It was a sign to me that I was accepted and I was embraced and that my ideas were actually heard and valued. And that is in turn what led to me actually writing back the article and speaking about my experience that has been shared for everybody to see and for potential employees in the future to actually have a look at what our environment is like and how embracing we are. And also spoke volumes on my colleagues who really supported and championed me through that process.
I think that's a fantastic example. And when you think about it, it's so obvious, isn't it? It seems so simple a thing to request as to how one wears one's hair that, you know, it just seems so obvious when you think about it that it doesn't necessarily affect people from other communities. So something as simple as that, and many other sort of similar programs could make such a difference, I think. And it goes back to what Nick was saying earlier about bringing your whole self to work. You know, sometimes it just seems so obvious, but it's things you don't think about unless you have these conversations, really. Matt?
Yeah, I wanted to touch a little bit on the part you were talking about earlier with the removing barriers to entry. And I do think it is a numbers game at times. The more people you get applying for the role, the greater chance that you're going to have a diversity within that selection of people. But I do think within certain professions, you know, potentially grant making, for example, where there is a systemic challenge with, you know, more white candidates being in that profession, I think by removing that barrier to entry doesn't necessarily remove those candidates from that selection. So it can become quite challenging sometimes to not offer interviews to candidates who've got the experience of something, even if it isn't essential. So I think one of the things that I've seen work quite well is, you know, if you reframe the role, you reframe the requirements of what you're looking for. You might not be looking for grant-making experience, but you could specifically state that you're looking for people with programmatic experience within the thematic areas of grant-making that you cover. And, you know, that means that, you know, if you have people who have got grant-making experience apply, but they don't have experience within those thematic areas, you've got justification to kind of really target different groups of people. And I think that's going to help bring different types of people to interview and ultimately lead to a diverse workforce from a completely different perspective. You know, people coming from different types of employment as well.
Yeah, it is really all about removing those barriers, isn't it? One thing I wanted to mention also is CV anonymization, anonymized CVs when it comes to recruitment processes. I just wondered if any of the panel have managed the processes. I think we have, but I wondered just wondered what people's thoughts were on anonymized applications. I mean, from Nick's perspective, I mean, from the advertising perspective, do you find that clients request anonymized processes at all? Is that something that's popular?
So from an advertiser perspective, what we tend to notice is the tools that clients are using in terms of their applicant tracking system. So the most prevalent one that's used is called Be Applied. Which is, as opposed to obviously CVs and anonymized CVs, candidates just have to answer normally three or four short questions, and then their marks are scored on that. And I think with different organizations, we've had interesting different feedback. One client recently that was really interesting was they'd implemented Be Applied maybe a year ago, just expecting by implementing that as a process that they would see a lot more diversity in their shortlist and application processes. But doing that as a standalone isn't going to have the impact that you'd hope and want, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You've really got to look at, you know, that's one part of the process. But once again, you've got to have a look at that whole process and how you're actually going out to market and obviously all your brand proposition, etc. And in order for it to have an impact on that end result in terms of that shortlist.
Yeah, so anonymized processes are simply a tool, but quite shallow without all of the removal of barriers, inclusive culture, visual branding, etc. So it is a tool, but nothing much more than a tool. Does anybody else have any thoughts on anonymized processes? Has anybody else run anonymized processes, and how did they go? Zola?
I definitely think that anonymized shortlists do make a difference. I think about myself as an example with my name. Often when I'm applying for jobs, I do fear that it will be used against me or that there will be some biases, most likely unconscious biases, really applied when reviewing my CV. So I definitely do think that once you just have initials and you remove that barrier of, well, this person could be from this race or could be from that background, and you're purely looking at their experience and their competencies, it makes a difference to who you bring forward because you've removed that layer and that boundary.
So it removes the potential for unconscious bias, I guess, which, you know, is something that does exist whether we like it or not. And, you know, unconscious bias is something that happens. So anonymized processes do support in that regard. Owais?
Yeah, just on that subject, I think anonymized processes just purely gives confidence to the candidates. And they know that once they submit their application, it's going to be blinded and there is going to be no bias against them. And historically, you know, within the community, from conversations I've had, people have felt like their name has actually put them back for whatever reason. So I think it's a great process. Obviously, a lot more needs to be done, but I think it's a fantastic tool, you know, which again, it is going on to the point of breaking barriers as well and just giving the reassurance to people to apply.
Yeah, so it's a really good point. It actually has an effect on candidates' confidence, that their candidates are confident that they will be taken on without unconscious bias and considered along with all of the other candidates on an equal footing, which is, it's a really good point, actually. And Matt?
Yeah, I kind of echo a lot of what's been said already, but I kind of really want to focus on what Nick said there. I think that as a tool, anonymized recruitment isn't going to necessarily give you the outcomes of having more diversity. It's going to make people feel more comfortable in applying. It could eventually do that. But I think in combination with the things that we've discussed, you are going to see great success in that. And I do think what you'll want to be doing is, once you've gone through those kind of anonymized recruitment processes, is, I mean, if you are collecting, you know, quality, diversity and inclusion monitoring data, you know, look at the people that are applying to your roles and look at the people that are being brought through. It's not impacting the outcomes. I think you need to look at the way it's being delivered and bringing more people into the, having more people from Black minoritized communities applying for your roles means there's going to be great success when you go through that anonymized recruitment process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Robert, I was just going to jump in there, Matt. And yeah, around that data and understanding your data is such a huge part of that, because if you're lucky enough to have good tracking systems where you're able to see where candidates are dropping out of your process. Is it at the application stage in the first instance, or is it at the interview stage, or the final offer stage? And being able to see that data and understand that data, and if you've got that equal opportunities data as well, you can then start to really, really analyze your whole process and see potentially where there might be those barriers that are meaning people from different minority communities aren't applying or are dropping out of the process. And so, yeah, that's a really personal point.
Excellent. Brilliant. Thank you all for that. So really, we wanted to finish with maybe a list of recommendations that we can share with the listeners. What actions can organizations take in its approach to recruiting in the immediate, mid and long term to improve greater representation for people from Black and minoritized communities? So let's go around the room, so to speak. Zola, would you like to start? What actions would you suggest organizations could take?
Of course, I would start with focusing on inclusion. If you want diversity that's sustainable, that is the best way for you to go. You should also use anonymization of applications. This cuts down on unconscious bias and also gives candidates the confidence that they'll be considered on an equal basis.
Thanks very much, Zola. And Matt, your suggestions?
Yes, I think it's really important to remove as many barriers as possible and reduce opportunities for bias to creep into the process. That way you're going to see greater diversity throughout, and that's when you know that you're getting it right. I also think it's really important to be ambitious. By that I mean, particularly with foundations, using their position and influence to encourage partner organizations, grantees, and stakeholders to adapt to strong EDI principles to improve the entire ecosystem within the sector. It's really important to share that best practice between you and the people you work with.
Great. Thank you, Matt. I would say challenge everything you do. Look at all of your practices at every stage of recruitment, from job design to appointment, and ask yourself the question, who does this practice exclude? If the answer is no one, carry on. If not, adapt the process accordingly. If you find that diverse shortlists are not translating into appointments, these could be some of the reasons why. After all, candidates from Black and minoritized communities are not intrinsically less interested in our sector, nor less qualified. It's just our processes and practices are excluding them. So, Nick, what about your suggestions?
Yeah, thanks, Robbie. I think the biggest point for me is utilizing data. And also to help drive change internally as well. You know, being able to look at where candidates are dropping off in the recruitment process and understanding where there might be potential obstacles and barriers to underrepresented groups means that you can help start to drive that change and hopefully support those candidates in their recruitment and application.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And finally, Awais, your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks for that, Rob. So I think organizations need to challenge how they're making appointment decisions and looking at what they're prioritizing. We know that the charity sector is significantly less diverse than the commercial sector. So if there's flexibility around this, they will see more diverse shortlists.
I think organizations need to be more flexible with the experience they're looking at. Also, you know, are they looking at candidates with certain qualifications? Do they prioritize candidates already? Know the organization that's going to inhibit applications from diverse candidates. And finally, if the organizations are serious about diversity, they should be willing to go back to the drawing board. And if it doesn't work the first time, rather than carry on and say, at least we tried, they should have more internal conversations on how they can improve diverse candidates coming in.
Fantastic. Excellent. Thank you so much. And Zola, I think you had one more point to add.
Yes, absolutely. Finally, I really wanted to add that there is little point on insisting on diverse shortlists if your workplace culture is not inclusive. So work on both in unison.
Excellent. Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. So as we draw to a close, we want to thank you very much for listening. We really hope that you found some of these points useful. We're very conscious that organizations will be at very different points in their EDI journey, of course, and solutions will differ for each organization. If you'd like to contact us directly, please do reach out to us via the Prospectus website or LinkedIn, and our panel members will be really happy to help with any specific interest or questions that you may have. We look forward to hearing from you, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Thank you ever so much.